live from New York City. It's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to lead off with the latest on healing. And also, for those who are concerned about having hardening of the arteries, which tens of million Americans have, plus, mind you, we're heard worldwide, all over the, almost in every country in the world. So this will help everyone everywhere. And that's just the beginning of about 20 points I'm going to be making on health and healing today. Then we're going to have some commentaries. I've written a commentary on the truth about our economy. And it's not anything near what you hear on all of the talking heads, the economists and the experts saying the economy is booming. We have very low unemployment, around 4.2%, 4.1%. There's a lot of good jobs. And we're in recovery mode. Not true. None of that is true. But I'm going to go through the figures and show you how you can see for yourself. They're only telling us what they want us to hear. Also today from our audio file, dear virtue signaling celebrities, I think it's time that we called out those celebrities who posture themselves as if they're social activists. Now, some are. Some are really. Mark Ruffalo and Sean Penn, and there's some really good ones out there, and I commend them, and I support them. But they're the minority. The vast majority of celebrities are not into anything that they should be, and especially when it comes to talking about homelessness in America. They'll tell you how bad it is. Are they opening up their homes? Many times they have multiple homes. And if they're not opening up their homes, they certainly could get together with some other celebrities and build some homes, nice affordable housing, in locations that are reasonable. It's not reasonable to, you know, go in and gut a building in downtown Los Angeles because, first of all, the real estate market is insanely overpriced. It's a bubble. For one-tenth that amount of money, you could go into the country, even providing a shuttle service, a bus, and you could they could buy a bus and hire a person that shuttles people from the inner city to really nice countryside, an hour away, where you could sleep 200-300 people, and not just sleep, have vocational skills, have psychological counseling. There's so much they could do. They have so much money, and they're not. So we're going to call them out, or someone's going to call them out today on the show. Also, we're going to call out the delusional students in colleges, not all are, but for those who are, how far do you think that the rest of the world is going to tolerate your intemperance towards wisdom, and you're smacking down everything that has historically allowed those who want to get a serious college education do so and prepare them for the real world. We're not going to allow you to suck all the air out of reason and wisdom into that vortex, that little bubble that so many of you live in, of just delusional thinking. So who better than Heather McDonald to explain that? And then if you thought that the National Security Agency was on your side, if you thought Mueller was on your side and the FBI, you're really delusional. We're going to have on whistleblower Russ Tice. You haven't heard of him? He was the first of the whistleblowers to talk about how he believes that the National Security Agency is intentionally getting blackmail material on people. It's a secret unit within the National Security Agency. It was working at night when everyone else was gone from the daytime shift, and that's when they did the dirty deeds. For the first time, you'll be hearing how bad, how down and dirty are they. And then on Monday, because of my schedule, I'll be traveling extensively over the next few days. I was going to do it tomorrow, but I won't have a chance. But Monday, we will begin to launch a one-year program once a week on defining the real axis of evil: Wikipedia, Facebook, and Google. Now, up to this point, they have virtually been untouchable. In fact, most people, including both the left and the right, consider them virtuous. That's only because they haven't done their homework. We have. And we have done a great deal. And everything we're going to share with you is true. It's just none of it is known by the American public. Our hope is that there might be a few honest journalists who still have the courage to do independent journalism. Those who do independent journalism don't have public forums. They might have a blog, but no one pays attention to those. So we're going to provide a forum to some 1,000 journalists who are not afraid to take on these people. That battle begins Monday. Up to this point, it's been a one-sided attack. They've attacked anyone who stood up on health, healing, alternative medicine, the economy. They've gone after alternative economists. They've gone after environmentalists. If you go after coal or oil or gas hydrofracking or nuclear, they can destroy your reputation. Because once they put you on their quack list, you're going to find it impossible to get off until now. Wait until you see what we've uncovered. And for all the lawyers in the audience, you may find that now you can sue these people who up to this point have felt virtually impervious and mocked and ridiculed. Oh, did I tell you that we got some of their comments of how much they think about people who try to challenge them or sue them? Well, let's see if we can't wipe the smirk off their face in the next 12 months. That battle begins Monday. But now, let us go to the latest on health and healing. And we're beginning with something that's important. This is from the University of Western Australia. It's published in the Journal of the American Heart Association. And it's really simple. In fact, it's so simple, it's almost, for most people, too simple. What a group of scientists found is that as you age, your arteries tend to thicken. Now, that thickening of the artery, and especially the carotid artery, that's C-A-R-O-I-O-T-I-D, carotid, that leads to strokes, major strokes. So what do? Now, you can take artificial blood thinners, okay? That can certainly help, but then you can end up dying of bleeding ulcers because it also destroys all your folic acid, vitamin B6, B12, and vitamin C. That also can lead to hemorrhaging, and people die. Over 25,000 Americans die each year from taking aspirin and some of the other blood thinners. So that's not good. Cruciferous vegetables are good. Your broccoli, cauliflower, cabbage, Brussels sprouts. Quote, this is one of the only studies that have explored the potential impact of different types of vegetables on measures of subclinical atherosclerosis, the underlying cause of cardiovascular disease. And that's the Dr. Lauren Bleckenhorst, the person who headed the University of Western Australia's study. And so the takeaway notion on this is that if you eat your cruciferous vegetables, including, by the way, onions and garlic and leeks and shallots, and if you eat more of your yellow and orange and red leafy vegetables and legumes, then sonograms were used to measure 954 Australian women, and indeed it helped the carotid artery wall become less thick. In fact, it helped all the entire carotid trees within your body and where the plaque builds up. And that is important. So researchers observed the millimeter lowering of the carotid artery wall thickness between high and low intakes of total vegetables. Quote, that is likely significant because 0.1 millimeter decrease in carotid wall thickness is associated with a 10 to 18% decreased risk in stroke and a heart attack. Wow, 18%. Now, that's just eating. Now, let's go to something that I've shared with people in lectures and counseling and at retreats. I do a whole three-hour lecture on it, but I'm going to give you the first a short version. I call it the laws of compensation. What do I mean? By the time you have been diagnosed with a classically defined disease, you are not at the beginning of the process. You're way towards death. The fact that the symptoms only begin to appear later doesn't mean that the original etiology, the original cause, came late. It came early. All those hot dogs, hamburgers, french fries, coffee, alcohol, smoking and the marijuana. Again, smoking marijuana is more dangerous than smoking cigarettes. Now, this is where you have to spare the issue. Do I believe that the cannabinoids, the essential oils of marijuana, can help you? Absolutely. With brain cancers and seizures and autism and lung cancer, one of the best things in the world you could take. In fact, it could be at the top of the list. Does taking the synthetic form work? No, and it's dangerous. Only use the natural. Is there scientific literature to back up the medicinal use of the cannabinoids for marijuana? Over 22,000 studies in PubMed, which is the government's official repository, what they use for the Library of Medicine. So if the government agencies want to know, does something work, they'll ask questions to the National Academy of Science. They'll be referred to the Library of Medicine. The Library of Medicine will look at peer-reviewed journals from PubMed, and then you get your answer. That's where those 22,000 studies are. So on the one hand, if the government says we should arrest people and put them in jail for using marijuana or stop people from having medical marijuana, that's just boneheaded obstinance. That's political. It has nothing to do with good science. Should we arrest people for using drugs? Not a single person should be arrested. Everyone who's used drugs should be let out of prison, their records expunged, and them getting the proper help to help both their body detoxify and also to get them out of any addictive behavior. So try to understand that smoking marijuana is dangerous. The scientific literature is substantial. That it can cause the same diseases like emphysema and lung disease that cigarette smoking cause. But it shouldn't be illegal and it shouldn't be withheld from people. But it's not the smoking the marijuana you're getting your benefit. It's the oils from that, which are 100 times more powerful without the euphoria. So I just want people to be clear. Otherwise, people hear what they want to hear and then they join the two issues together, and that confuses people. So when we're in the process of rebalancing the body from any illness, since you have been radical in the extreme, you have been the ultimate nutrition anarchist. Everything humanly possible you could do against your body, your cells, your eyes, your heart, your brain, your lungs, your testes, you've done. You've gone in there with a battering ram and just beat the hell out of everything that exists in your body. You've killed billions of cells. Billions. You've killed them with intent. It wasn't by accident. So now, how eating a little healthier, do you think it's going to reverse that? It won't. You've got to compensate. The compensation means that the degree that you have injured yourself, you have to go to the other extreme. You have to be almost radically minded, meaning you must get out of your hyper-conservative mindset of, I don't want to do anything too radical. I don't want to have too many glasses of juice or too many vitamins. You give someone 7 vitamins and they think their head just exploded. How am I supposed to have a life and take 7 vitamins a day? My God. Well, you just ate 21 french fries with one meal. Well, that's different. Why is it different? You just had 2,000 grains of sugar and a tablespoon of sugar that you put in your beverage. That's different. Why is it different? You just ate 10 times more protein in that steak than what your body can actually process or needs. That's different. No, your rationalization is what you think makes a difference. And point of fact, we have never as a society put our energy into being either happy or healthy. Almost everything we do gets us the elements that we think will make us happy. It doesn't. And we think as long as we don't have a disease, we're healthy. We're not. So when I work with people, by the way, just so people understand, A, I only work with terminally ill people. B, if they don't give me a commitment to change 100% plus, I don't work with them. There's no purpose to it. I'm not bound by guilt and shame as most Americans are. I don't think that I'm a better person for trying to help someone who is going to intentionally self-sabotage and then make excuses, and I'm supposed to be empathetic and listen to their excuses. I've been down that road. It doesn't work with me. Share that with someone who actually believes you. I don't. If you're going to be healthy, then you have to convince yourself without a coach or anyone else that you're capable of doing it, because you sure as hell didn't need a team to get sick. That's that kind of conversation we're not willing to have in our society because we don't want anyone to feel bad about themselves. Well, it's not important how you feel. It's important what you do, so that otherwise how you would feel if you didn't do the right thing doesn't happen. And that means you must overcompensate. You don't have one glass of juice. Ask the people who are on these protocols. How in the world do you think that Kenny, the end-stage multiple sclerosis reversed and is totally healthy for the last 11 years and is board-certified neurologist, can find no myelin sheath damage in his body? Do you think he did it by having, you know, some salad, a cup of brown rice, a glass of green tea once a month? Not too often. And I keep hearing this all the time. In fact, there's someone very famous. Everyone in this audience knows this person. And I got this person to lose 85 pounds and start on the road to health, and boom, like that. When I wasn't there, they went right back on the wagon, which means that they did not surrender their addictive behavior only when they're being watched, when they're being in the presence of someone who's not going to accept their excuses. But most people, unfortunately, they feel that somehow their life's not their own. It's been turned over to circumstances beyond their control. So I have never seen anyone cured of a terminal condition in my life who had a negative attitude. I've seen a lot of people cured of every disease imaginable who finally grew up, stopped the baby mindset, and said, damn, if I put myself in harm's way, I can sure as hell get myself out of harm's way, and I'm going to do it. That's the person that is cured. That's the person that survives. And it takes compensation, compensation at the spiritual level, compensation at the emotional level, at the physical level. And when you compensate, I've got people taking 16 glasses of juice a day, some people over 100 supplements a day. Now, do you think the average person is going to do that? They'd rather die. So that's why it's not just everybody who suddenly finds themselves at death's door is going to radically change. Most people, the vast majority of people, would rather go to their death believing in orthodoxy than trust that they have an innate capacity to heal. So now, when I was, by the way, I'm going to be filming, I just filmed John McDougall out in California. I'm filming Dean Ornish, who is, there's a good example. I have an enormous amount of respect for Dean Ornish. He was the first to prove scientifically that you could reverse heart disease with diet and exercise and stress management. And I was the only journalist at the time who was actually there in New York filming him working with his patients. And we had several conversations about this. He would go on to publish a landmark study in the British Medical Journal, The Lancet, as well as separately one as a follow-up study in the New England Journal of Medicine. By every standard, he followed orthodoxy's rules. And by every standard, they denied the significance. So we could have easily saved 12 million people from a premature death had the medical community embraced the plant-based diet that he was advocating. The science was there, the publications were there, the peer-reviewed journals were there, the discussions at scientific conferences were there. He is board certified in his field. Every single criteria that they say you must show us this and then we'll do it. Well, that's the lie of medicine. Even when shown the truth, they will not embrace it. There are a few, a handful, who have, and guess what? I filmed them too. And each one of those board-certified cardiologists that embraced the plant-based diet, that Dean Ornish was the first physician, not the first physician to use it, the first to actually be a mainstream orthodox physician who published the results and shared it. It's just that he was sharing it with a group of people who weren't going to change. I mean, how likely is it that your doctor is going to advocate a diet for you that is completely opposite their own diet? And supplements for you when they don't take supplements. And exercise for you when they're overweight. And stress management for you when they're wound as tight as you can be. That's the human element. So anyway, I'm glad that this study was done. And I'll do more on this subject of compensation a little later on in the series that I'm doing. From Gandhi Center for Biotechnology in India, they found that ginger can be stronger than chemotherapy for fighting cancer. Now, we've heard of other nutrients like curcumin, and black cumin seed oil is also beneficial. So we all know that ginger is a healthy addition to any meal, and that it can reduce nausea and inflammation in the human body. It's a food with curative powers that have been highly regarded for centuries. And though science is still unlocking its secrets, coincidentally, three researchers from the Gandhi Center for Biotechnology in India may have just stumbled upon one of those secrets, and it will likely have a far-reaching implication for cancer treatment field, at least for those holistic oncologists. For the rest, it won't. Because there's no money in ginger, there's a lot of money in chemotherapy. But these scientists have found that there is a chemical in ginger called 6-shogaol, S-H-O-G-A-O-L, which has an impressive effect against breast cancer cells. It also targets cancer stem cells in particular, which are largely responsible for spreading cancer throughout the body, as well as spurring the growth of tumors that have been previously treated with chemotherapy or surgery. And best of all, it is effective at doses that aren't harmful to non-cancerous cells, unlike chemotherapy. In fact, the researchers decided to see how this chemical in ginger could stack up against a traditional chemotherapy drug named Taxol, T-A-X-O-L. And while Taxol is known to inhibit ordinary cancer cells and cause a host of terrible side effects, it still struggles to eliminate cancer stem cells. So the researchers tested the Taxol at a concentration that was 10,000 times higher than the ginger samples, and it still wasn't as effective at destroying cancer stem cells as the ginger chemical. So ginger and the 6-shogaol in it reduced the expression of the CD44 and CD24 cancer stem cell surface markers in breast cancer. It significantly affected the cell cycle, resulting in increased cancer cell death. It induced programmed cell death, primarily through the induction of autophagy with secondary inducers of killing cancer cells. It inhibits breast cancer formation by altering notch signaling pathway through inhibition. So it's just terrific. And finally, from Tufts University, published in the journal Nutrients, pecans. Or you can call them pecans. Either way, it's P-E-C-A-N-S. They're both correct. and they can improve certain markers related to cardiometabolic health. So eating a handful of pecans every day for 4 weeks improves certain markers of cardiometabolic disease risk, including insulin sensitivity, among a group of overweight and obese adults with excessive abdominal fat. That's the vast majority of adults. So you reduce your risk of diabetes and heart disease. That could save some lives, and that's important. Taking a break, coming back with a commentary on poverty in America. Please stay with us. From all over the world, people are listening on syndicated stations. They're listening. And just this past week, I was given some figures that 33,000 people listening over the telephone. We've got 17 streaming services. One of them is for phones, and that was just this week. So I want to thank you for using the phone, either a hardland phone or a cell phone. Let me give you the number in case you didn't write it down. 424-203-8046. So wherever you're at, in Canada, the United States, or wherever your cell phone works, just dial 424-203-8046. Or go to your cell phone, you'll see a store, go to the app, and you'll see PRN.FM. And you get crystal clear signal anywhere that that cell phone works, anywhere in the world. Now, I'm going to do a commentary here in a moment, but this is just the lead in to it, because I believe that we should call out those celebrities who posture themselves on these social issues. And it's very easy to say that you support something, but how far is it that you go in support of it? Making a public statement, that doesn't cost you a nickel. And the media always loves to hear a celebrity talking about something. But I want to acknowledge the good celebrities, the conscientious celebrities, who have taken their time, their own resources, to help those in need. I commend you for that. Martin Sheen is one of those people. As long as I've known of Martin Sheen, he's always been a social activist. And so there are a lot of them like that. That's not Charlie Sheen. That's his father, Martin Sheen. Altogether different cut of cloth there. Now we're going to hear a short segment from someone who is calling out by virtue, what's called virtue signaling, how virtuous they are. Let's see how it plays out in real life.
This is Harry Potter author J.K. Rowling. Net worth, $1 billion. She really cares about the plight of refugees, and she demands that Britain take in more migrants. Now, I'm sure that J.K. Rowling has donated a lot of money to refugee charities, but money is not enough. 250,000 homes will have to be built every year in the UK just to house British people and the 300,000 plus immigrants that already arrive annually. The UK has a chronic housing shortage. J.K. Rowling doesn't have a chronic housing shortage. Here's her 12-acre estate and 9-bedroom mansion in Aberfeldy. Here's her mansion in Edinburgh, which has 31 rooms, including 13 bedrooms. J.K. Rowling lives with her husband and 3 children. Let me do the math here. 4 bedrooms needed, 22 minus 4. That means J.K. Rowling has 18 spare bedrooms. Oh yeah, and I forgot to mention her $10 million, 856 hectare, 7-bedroom mansion estate in Tasmania that has a 3-kilometre driveway. J.K. Rowling had a house worth £1 million next to her Edinburgh mansion, flattened. To build a small migrant centre? No, to extend her own garden. But she also put up 2 extra buildings on the property. To house Syrian refugees? No, they're Hogwarts-style tree houses. But we know that J.K. Rowling cares deeply about the needy and impoverished. I mean, she tweets about it all the time. In fact, she cares so much about the little people that she's got 30-foot trees all the way around her property to block them out. Given her relentless demand that the UK take in more refugees, along with her 18 spare bedrooms, J.K. Rowling must be doing her bit, right? Actual number of refugees housed by J.K. Rowling... and it's zero. Mike Cernovich has offered to pay flight costs for up to 100 refugees if J.K. Rowling, net worth 1 billion, promises to house them. And I'll be happy to match that offer. J.K. Rowling, it's time to put up or shut up. This is ex-soccer star and TV host Gary Lineker, net worth 31.5 million. Gary lives in Barnes, Richmond, one of the whitest areas in London. There are very few migrants living in Barnes. Gary said it was hideously racist to even question whether these refugee children arriving in the UK were actually children, even though facial recognition showed some of them to be nearly 40 years old. Tommy Robinson challenged Gary to adopt one of these children. Gary's response was to call Tommy a racist idiot. Afterwards, Gary announced he'd attend a rally in support of Calais migrant camp children, then failed to show up. But Gary really cares about refugee children. That's why he accommodates them in his six-bedroom luxury home. Oh, wait, actual number of refugees housed by Gary Lineker, and it's zero. Gary Lineker, it's time to put up... or shut the... This is actress Emma Thompson, net worth 64 million. Emma says the UK is racist for not taking in enough refugees. She says we'd take more if they were white. Emma Thompson lives in Hampstead, which is 98% white. In fact, it's one of the whitest areas in the whole of London. There are very few migrants living in Hampstead. Despite the UK being the most crowded country in Europe, Emma says there's plenty of room to accept thousands more migrants. But there's no room at her place because the actual number of refugees housed by Emma Thompson is zero. Emma Thompson, time to put up... or shut up. This is pop star Lily Allen, net worth 20 million. Lily lived in a six-bedroom house in the Cotswolds. The Cotswolds is one of the whitest areas in the UK. There are very few migrants living in the Cotswolds. Then she moved to Notting Hill, one of the whitest areas in London. Lily Allen apologised on behalf of her country and wept on national TV, insisting that the UK should accept more child refugees. Actual number of refugees housed by Lily Allen... zero. Lily Allen, it's time to put up or shut up. This is wealthy musician and Live Aid icon Bob Geldof, net worth 150 million. Geldof owns a number of properties, including a mansion house in Kent and a mansion apartment in Battersea. When Geldof is not flipping the bird to working-class fishermen in support of the European elite, he's busy virtue signalling about refugees. He called the refugee crisis a sickening disgrace. Back in September 2015, Geldof promised to house four Syrian refugee families. Actual number of refugees housed by Bob Geldof? Zero. Bob Geldof, it's time to put up or shut up. This is ex-soccer star turned radio host Stan Collymore, net worth 35 million. 18 months ago, Stan said, quote, "I'll take a Syrian family in my home for a year tomorrow." He lambasted others on Twitter for not doing enough for refugees. 18 months later, actual number of refugees housed by Stan Collymore, and it's zero. Stan Collymore, it's time to put up or shut up. None of these ultra-rich celebrities.
Here is the point. We have enough wealthy celebrities and wealth in all different areas that if we merely began to look at what we can do, more than just saying we support the need for people having an opportunity for a new life in our country. Remember, Anne Frank's father, back as early as 1939, went through the proper channels, and he was a very politically connected person. He was very well known and respected within the Jewish community. He was considered one of the most progressive and liberal Jews at the time, very much a humanitarian, very gentle person. And even with contacts in the United States and the help of people in the United States, he could not get it. Why? Because multiple ships loaded with people wanting to come to the United States were turned away. A couple of those ships had to go back to Frankfurt, and as a result, they were all imprisoned. And it was his effort to come to the United States. His brother had made it out. He didn't. So when we think about all the people who have been migrants coming from countries with civil war or any form of fascism, we must think carefully what it means to have blanket rejections and who then would not have made it into America's shore, and we all benefited from them. Einstein, I can give you a long list of over 1,000 famous people. So I believe that we should have a little different approach and not just be ideological. But in the process, think of the people who are here who are not celebrities. They're just regular people. And what can we do to help those who are here? Well, one of the things we can do is we can build homes, let's say homes that have a completely sustainable environment, growing food hydroponically, quality water, and even associate with sociologists, humanistic psychologists, holistic medical clinics. All that could be in one simple community. The key is not doing it in the cities, because the city, even though there are 10 million square feet of non-used space that the government owns, the bureaucracy and the politics of trying to get the city to do or state or the federal government to do anything is insurmountable. Go to the country. Go to places in the country where you don't have the zoning restrictions. And if you took two or three friends and you each contributed something, and even if you only contributed what you would be taxed on, rather than giving it to a foundation like the American Cancer Society or some of these other places like the Red Cross that took $500 million and built six homes in Haiti, that would have cost them under $100,000. What did they do with the other $499,500,000? Went into their general fund. I don't give a nickel to any of these major foundations, but hundreds of billions of dollars a year are given. So what if we didn't do that? You could easily start a nonprofit foundation. I started one. I don't ask anyone for money, just so that it has a future. It's called Veterans Village. I'm helping homeless vets have a place to stay. Now, if I can take, from the time I've been in New York at a fertile farm upstate to this day, over 300 homeless people into my homes over the years and help them, why can't the average rich celebrity take in one? If every celebrity in Hollywood, hiding behind their gated walls and protected by armed police, why can't these people spend some money instead of on their publicist, spend it on helping to support a homeless person? Interview the people. Interview the people to make sure that they're going to appreciate the gift and grow from it, become able to get back into life. There's nothing wrong with you being concerned about selecting the right people. And that's fine. But do something other than just get on television, say you're concerned about something, and then walk away as if somehow something should happen because you said it. Just a thought that we could actually do something meaningful. Quietly. No publicity, no fanfare. Now a few thoughts on the economy. I want to see how the stock market was being analyzed, the ups and downs, 700 points up, 500 lost day before yesterday, then rebound 380-some yesterday, then off to a bad start today. And all the economists say the same thing. The economy is extremely good. All the indicators show that Americans have a lot of faith in our economy, that new jobs are being created, and that the tax bill that was passed is really helping to create those jobs. And with unemployment around 4.1%, we shouldn't be angry about anything. The trouble is all that is misinformation. Write this down, please. These are actual facts, not the fraud and the fake information the government and the New York Times and Wall Street Journal and CNN give you. There are approximately 231 to 232 million Americans. Of those, you have 18 and under, 74.2 million. Over 65, you have 48 million. Those who are currently working for full-time, you have 126 million. Part-time work, 28 million. So if you took part-time and full-time, it's 154 million. Here is the problem. There's 95 million Americans who could work, can't find work, and as a result are not working. 95 million who could work and are not working versus 154 million who are working does not mean the unemployment level is at 4.1%. The actual realistic unemployment level in the United States is minimally 28% and could go as high as 36%, depending upon if you're African American or Latino. And so they've lied about how many people are not employed. But that's just the beginning of it. We have to go further. We have to start looking at college students. Why? Because the latest studies show something terrible is happening, that upwards to 20% of college students are so financially insecure that for all intents and purposes, they don't have enough food at the end of the day or a place to stay. They're couch surfing. They're hanging out. They're surviving as best they can. They're in college. And how many is that? Well, we have 15.2 million people in public colleges and universities. We have 5.5 million in private schools. More often than not, the private schools are not suffering at the same level as the people in public schools and universities. That's 20.7 million young people in school. And that means that 19% of adolescents in school are living below the federal poverty line. So let's just round it off to 20%. You're dealing with 5 million college kids are living below the poverty line. Where's the movement for them? Where are the marches for them? Where's the faculty for them? Where are the teachers, the adjuncts for them? Oh, I forgot. There are none. Where's the media? When was the last time you saw the media covering what it's like to be living below the poverty line and trying to survive in school? That's a legitimate concern and one that is necessary to focus on. But it gets worse if you're Black or Latino. In fact, the latest study from USA Today shows that there's a major inequality crisis. Blacks and Latinos are on the road to zero wealth, meaning you've got no savings, no investments, and no home equity. If you have a home, more often than not, the mortgage is higher than the equity because whatever equity people had in the heyday, people borrowed, not realizing the moment if you bought your home at $100,000, the market now says $200,000, pay off the mortgage. No, people borrowed and bought stuff with it. Well, now you don't own that home at that value. The equity's gone. You've used the equity, and now you have debt. Now you owe $200,000 to people who are going to charge you compounding interest and not going to give you an advantage.
You must be a special lady.
You'll be singing first, second, or second?
No, Harry, I'm singing second, man.
And a very exciting girl.
I'll bring that bass out, man.
Hey, man, I'll bring it out a little bit more.
You gotta be a special lady.
Let's get down on some harmony, come on.
Cause you got me sitting on top of the world. Sitting on top of the world.
By 75%, decrease by 75%. So we should be dealing with it. In fact, for those African Americans and Black who have college educations, who are gainfully employed, who have been conscientious about the choices they've made economically, they are to be commended. Now there should be a movement within those communities where the leaders of the communities, the churches and the other groups, the lawyers, the engineers, the professors, the CPAs, all the professionals in the African-American Latino community should start helping all the others within the community rise up. But that also means making that a commitment, making that time. And unfortunately, African-Americans, Latinos are no less susceptible to gentrification. And as they increase their income, increase the value of their holdings, are going up the ladder, which they deserve. They've worked for that. They frequently move out of the neighborhoods they once lived in, and they take on new priorities. And with some exceptions, the old priorities are lost or forgotten. So I think it's time that we ask those who've succeeded in every community, every ethnicity, not to forget those who still need help. Because there's enough wealth, there's enough millionaires, multimillionaires, even billionaires within the African-American Latino community to make an enormous difference in helping to ghettoize areas and helping with scholarships. And some have. And some are actually doing good with their money very quietly. No fanfare, no publicity, and I commend them. Denzel Washington is one of those individuals who very quietly, and I know this for a fact, has helped a lot of people get the same opportunities that he has been given in. And so we should have more people who care about people from their own communities instead of just going forward. We also have to look at the reality. Tanya Diaz Bazan used the statistics from the Chicago Booth Kellogg School of Financial Trust Index, and it showed that Americans are angrier at the current economic situation, particularly low-income people. So why aren't we talking with low-income people? Why aren't we seeing specials on low-income people? What's their life like? How do you get through a day? This summer, I'm getting a RV outfitted to spend a month on the road, and I'm going to be out in California filming, first in San Francisco and then in Los Angeles, starting there and then going elsewhere. And just to give you an idea, in Los Angeles right now, there's one street, 50 blocks long. Every single square inch is taken by poor people living on the street. Now, that leads from another street that's also long, and this is right when you're on that street and you look up, you see all the skyscrapers and the big expensive apartments. So you've got for the average person, you've got an oasis or a desert. Look down the street, you've got a desert. Look up, and you've got an oasis. What does it tell us about we as a society when we allow this disparity and this inequality and this suffering in plain sight? How could anyone with a conscience drive through that neighborhood and not say, what can I do to help these people? These are human beings. These are sacred souls. It's not for me to criticize how these people got on the street. No. I'm just lucky I'm not on the street. And would I want someone to try to give me a hand to acknowledge my suffering if I were on the street? Sure. Then why should I be any different? And when you have that many 10 million millionaires and their family, it's 40 million people, and over 65 million professionals with their families. That's 100 million Americans. That's one-third the population, nearly, about 27%. How can you have this much wealth and this much poverty and we not pay attention to what we can do? We're waiting on the government? Good luck with that. And by the way, 71% of all Americans think the U.S. economy is rigged. That's according to Aubrey Shea of Fortune magazine. Quote, unemployment in America may hit a 40-year low. That's a lie. They're smarter than that. They should do their homework, because I just gave you the actual figures. But few Americans are taking comfort in numbers. According to a new poll, nearly three-quarters of Americans believe the U.S. economy is rigged. They are correct. It is rigged. And you're not on the side of benefiting from it being rigged. And by the way, what about how many seniors are living in poverty? First, you know how many seniors there are. Well, there are 48 million. And how are they doing? Not so good. Why? 19.3 million seniors in the United States are living at the poverty level. Whoa. Out of 48 million? Wow. That means we've got an awful lot of, 20 million are living in poverty. 21 million, actually. Quote, nearly 21 million people ages 65 and older had incomes below 200% of poverty under the SPM of 2016, which is 42.4%. That means that 42.4% of seniors are living under extreme financial constraints. Well, when did we have a march for them? When did we have a national effort to try to help our grandparents and senior citizens, those who could be eating cat food instead of regular food? So doesn't it tell you something about how we get absolutely Ruby Payne, Les Leopold, Gary Leach, Professor Harvey Cox, and others. That's what's coming at us. And so all that will be on Sunday evening, all those people and myself in a webinar on poverty. If you want to join us, 6:30 Sunday evening, go to prn.fm or garynull.com, and you can see the information so that you can be a part of that. So, Sunday evening, if you want to hear people like Chris Hedges and Gerald Salante and Glenn Ford, A Black Agenda Report, and almost 20 of the greatest minds in the country, Richard Wolff and Michael Hudson and Dennis Kucinich and Ralph Nader, they're all going to be 6:30 to 9 o'clock, 3 hours, maybe even a little longer. You'll be able to hear some of the finest conscientious people, real social activists, joining me in a special on Poverty, Inc. And so go to prn.fm or garynull.com if you'd like to participate. Unfortunately, I was just told that the signal dropped out. We have been having all forms of the troll attacks. Evidently, when word got out that I'll be going after these people, that now the trolls are in full force, that's fine. It will not stop our efforts. But I believe that we can come up with an awful lot of good material for the people who are needing help. Not just people who are on the streets, just people who can't balance their bank book. They don't have enough income. And what are the rules that we can learn? How can we learn to be more economic and more conscientious? What can we do to get out of this grip of debt? So many people are in debt. So many people in America can't go 2 weeks without a paycheck. They would be destitute. That's not good. So we're going to have some very wise minds exploring this and showing you what we can do. Sunday evening, 6:30, Ralph Nader, Dennis Kucinich, Chris Hedges, and a whole lot of wonderful minds helping us understand the problem and the solutions to this enormous debt. And by the way, we've got enormous debt. I don't have time now to go into the figures, but if I, on an upcoming program, I'll show you the actual figures, and it'll just blow your mind. But we are critical of other countries when they go into debt, when their debt is 100% of their income. We're 1,200% debt to income. We're bankrupt, and we have no gold to back up our currency. It's a fiat currency. We've been manipulated by the central banks, and so we're in a really bad position, and we put all of our money into the military-industrial complex, but not into social services. And there's a price to pay when we become indifferent, where the public doesn't pay attention, because our people are paying attention and they're taking advantage of us. So I'm going to deal with that. We're out of time, everyone. Thank you all for listening. I look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day. I'm looking. I'm gonna find